This is episode 25 with Dr. James Giordano and Rob Dubay.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligence Leadership Podcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. Today, my co-guests are Dr. James or Jim Giordano and Rob Dubay. Dr. Giordano is a neuroscientist and neuroethicist focusing upon mechanisms and treatment of neuropsychiatric spectrum disorders and neuroethical issues generated by brain science and its applications in medicine, public life, and military intelligence and warfare. He is a professor in the Department of Neurology and Biochemistry and chief of the Neuroethics Studies Program at Georgetown University. Rob Dubay is the co-CEO and co-founder at Image One, which was recognized as one of the top 25 small businesses in America as a Forbes Small Giant Company in 2017. Rob is the author of Do Nothing, the most rewarding leadership challenge you'll ever take. And he hosts leadership retreats to help leaders do nothing as a means to unplug and rejuvenate their minds. I'm really excited to have Dr. Giordano on for his second visit as a guest on the podcast. If you missed it, you can catch his deep insights on futures intelligence in episode 11. In this episode, Rob discusses the practical practices of mindfulness that he utilizes for himself and other leaders, while Jim provides the insights into the neural correlates or brain mechanisms of the experiences. As always, this discussion is focused around the impacts this has on futures intelligence leadership. So if you're interested in why leaders need to understand that their brain is a system within a system, embedded in a system, how to remove mental busyness, how mindfulness impacts brain traits and states, how to purposefully utilize personal bias as a leader, how to unwind detrimental thought loops, why the brain is a Bayesian processor, and how that impacts the ability to predict and make decisions towards a specific future, why the brain is the original virtual reality device, the neuroscience of awareness and focus, the power of the word because, and why your brain might be a generator, antenna, or receptor for consciousness, then this episode is for you. Let's listen. So thank you, Rob and Jim, for joining me today on this episode. And as always, I want to start with this key question of how can leadership be more intelligent about futures given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And love for you both to answer it from your own perspective and your own work. And I'd like to start with Rob.
Well, thanks for having me, Tyler. Yeah. And it's great to be here with you, Jim. I haven't met you before, but I'm excited to have a dialogue with you. I think that that's a big question. First of all, I don't know that I'm absolutely qualified to answer it, but I have thoughts around it. And I think that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. One area that's been useful for me as a leader and others that I've worked with is to cultivate and have a regular meditation practice. For me, I started my business 29 years ago, and I found that running the business was a very stressful thing for me. And I looked for different ways to help mitigate that. In 2005, I was introduced to a meditation practice when I was sort of at the height of much of my anxiety, and I found it to be a really useful thing for me, both in my personal life and in my business life as a leader. And so an area where I found it to show up best is my ability to be more present with people within my organization. outside of my organization. And I think that translates into more openness, more vulnerability, and the ability to have better conversations to come to a better place for all parties. So there are many other thoughts I have on the subject, Tyler, but this was just one I wanted to start with.
Yeah, great. And Jim, from your perspective, how do you answer the question?
Wow, this is a big question. So of course, my particular area of expertise, as you know from my previous engagement on the show, is the neurocognitive sciences. I'm a brain scientist. And interestingly, one of the ongoing efforts in the brain sciences is to try to determine what are the neurocognitive bases that are participatory, contributory, or in some cases strongly correlated, if not wholly subserving, these higher functions that allow us to engage each other both as individuals and in groups. And I think this becomes very important to shed some light on both what Rob is saying and his experience over the years. You know, when we talk about these practices such as mindfulness, whether it's mindful meditation or mindful focus or just mindful, quote, leadership and cognitive styles, what we're really doing is we're changing the way our cognitive patterns work. And of course, it's not a direct one-to-one correlation, but there have been some very interesting studies that have shown certain changes in the way the brain functions to engage various nodes and networks that are involved not only in higher cognitive function, but in more fundamental cognitive processes that have to do with our emotionality and the way our emotions respond. And we can certainly talk about that in more detail a bit later. But I think that the point that really Rob is bringing home is that it's important for our listening audience to understand that humans are biopsychosocial organisms. We have a biology. We're embodied creatures, but we're embedded within our environments. And those environments are ecological and social. And certainly we respond to those environments psychologically, and we contribute to those environments psychologically, which then brings us to the idea that humans are systems that are nested in systems. So if, in fact, what we're trying to do is lead, then understanding the dynamics of that system, not only from the top down, from the leadership perspective down into the proverbial ranks, but how the, if you will, ranks contribute to the dynamic of the organization and leadership. And I think it really brings into stark relief that rather old adage that the best leaders are those who have been led.
Just kind of playing with this and moving in another direction a little bit. Also, with your work, Rob, you wrote a book called Do Nothing, and you do retreats. I'm curious, you know, you've had some good results with meditation. What other types of results are you seeing from people you're working with?
Well, as it relates to the retreats, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is the appreciation that people begin to have when they get away and are able to shut everything off and be with themselves. They're not accustomed to that, and we aren't in our worlds, in our most of our lives. We really, maybe even since we were born, never had the opportunity to just sit with ourselves and with our mind. And so, depending on how long one is on a retreat, my experience has been, and the experience I hear from others, is that there's a process that begins to unfold where there's some surface aspects of what's going on in your mind, sort of the regular day-to-day joys and frustrations and et cetera. And somewhere along the lines, maybe 2 to 3 days in, depending on, again, how long you're on retreat, those start to subside and new thoughts and things that are going on sort of at a deeper level begin to arise. And you become aware of those and you start becoming curious about what's happening and where that's coming from, or maybe you know exactly where it's coming from. It just hasn't had an opportunity to show itself because we've been so busy. Then it all starts to subside and there's a quietness, and that's the beauty. And that's where you recognize full presence and awareness and start to notice things in a much more vibrant way. So I imagine there's something going on in our minds, Jim, when this is going on. This is just the experience I have.
Yeah, Jim, what's your kind of take on this? When you're sitting with yourself, what's going on in their brain?
Well, you know, what Rob is actually describing is the phenomenology of the, as the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio describes it, the feeling of what happens from within. Mm-hmm. You know, this is very interesting because if you think of leadership, leadership is essentially about others. What we're really doing there is we're controlling others, we're guiding others, we're directing others. And in many ways, we're trying to let others emulate what we do. But certainly it involves that level of guidance, if not governance. But what becomes so important and why these efforts in mindfulness, I think, are critical to develop good leadership is that you have to understand that we perceive the entirety of the world in the first person subjective. And it's very difficult to extricate ourselves from our subjectivity. Even those things that we think are the most altruistic have an egoistic component. If I'm going to do something good for someone, that has to resonate with me in some way, cognitively, emotionally, with some form of viable benefit for me on a variety of levels, from the implicit all the way to the very, very explicit. Leadership is no different. When we lead, what we're finding is there's a commitment to some cause, to some purpose, but then we're engaging with people in a process to do that. And feeding that through the lens of our subjectivity very often nests us from within. How then does the leader become far more sensitive to the dynamics and domains and dimensions of the system in which they're embedded and which they're trying to lead? And what Rob is describing is that phenomenological process of what's sometimes referred to as ego dissolution. How do I move away from the phenomenological subjectivity of myself? And in many ways, what this involves is particular networks in the brain, which we can talk about momentarily, and move into a far more embedded and engaged phenomenology, a neurophenomenology, that allows us to appreciate otherness in a much more definable way. So that essentially what we've done is we've expanded our subjectivity to include a broader phenomenology. And that can sound very new agey, but their neuroscience that backs it up, I think is really very interesting to demonstrate what nodes and networks in the brain are differentially activated and recruiting during this process, both as a trait and as a state.
One of the things that was interesting you're talking about is this, the idea of you're kind of expanding your subjectivity. And it seems what you're saying is that you're actually expanding your sense of self to other people, right? And that's actually happening also within the brain. Is that correct?
That's right. You know, and it happens, what Rob described was perfect. It happens in two ways. It happens first as a state change, in other words, as an acute or subacute phase. So by practicing these forms of introspection and mindfulness, what we tend to find is that there is a shift in some of the electrical patterns of the brain. So for example, there tends to be a presence of lower frequency, we call alpha waves, on the electroencephalogram, and a durable presence of theta waves. In other words, we become more concentrated, not just concentrating. And then we also see that there are a number of different brain areas that are differentially and diversely engaged. Most of them have to do with sort of higher associative engagement and higher associative cognitive processing, but not all. And that's what becomes so important. So we know, for example, that one of the areas of the brain that is very relevant to the way we process our subjectivity and we process our experience of not only what was, but what will come, is this interesting network that involves a brain area known as the anterior cingulate cortex, the prefrontal cortex, and the temporoparietal junction. In other words, the way our brains essentially work is we match our present to some experience or things we've known in the past or things that are similar in the past. And then what we do is make value judgments in terms of what predictions our decisions and action will occur for certain consequences. And we do that both for ourselves and we do that for those individuals we lead. This is used to be referred to as the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act. And some of my ongoing work with my colleague Diane DeUlis and Bill Kaysbier have added a little bit more to that. We know that we base certain things on biases that we've had from our prior experiences that are reinforced differentially by the consequences we evoke, and not only for us, but for others. So for the leader, leading both by example and leading by experience becomes very important so as to be able to create those intrinsic biases, not necessarily by experience, but by their erudition to those they lead. But when you become more mindful, what you're really doing is becoming more sensitive to the environments and the dynamics of the systems in which you're embedded. And that's really important. What I'd like to do, if I may, if I could take five more minutes, I want to highlight some of the work of some of my colleagues, because I think it's paramount. This is some of the work of my colleague Nico Kohls in Germany, Harald Wallach, Stefan Schmidt, Tobias Esch, and a very interesting study looking at mindfulness practices in the military by Dr. Fred Zimmermann. And what we've seen is that the brain states change. We know that there's more of a focus and there's more of an openness. In other words, it's less about me and more about those things that are around me, both in the moment and those things that may speak to certain biases. The Stoics sort of referred this as apatheia, and in other words, not necessarily apathy per se, but coming away from the situation in a way that is more reflective and less emotionally engaged. And we know that, as Rob just said, that after a period of time, it's not just the acute state of the brain, but actually traits of the brain. So now you see changes in those brain nodes and networks that process what we call meta-awareness. And that's very, very interesting because it actually differentially engages or leaves relatively primed the brain's activity network and default network that in some cases has been strongly implicated with our capability of daydreaming, being creative and being innovative, but not just to ourselves, to seeing that level of innovation in others. And I think that's obviously a very good trait for leaders.
Go ahead, Rob.
For you, being a neuroscientist, what is it like to describe what's happening in the mind for you personally? Knowing what's going on in the mind, almost your mind seeing your mind, and how do you use that on a daily basis?
That's a great question.
So do I have a crystal ball into my own neurocognitive? it's a really good question, Rob. I have a very dear colleague, an esteemed colleague of mine. His name is Professor Patricia Churchland, and Dr. Churchland has said that we need to be a little bit more introspective of our own neurological processes. And I like that idea. I mean, I think in concept, that's great. And for those of us who do the brain sciences, I might be able to actually reflect, this is my brain doing X, Y, or Z. You know, I mean, certainly if you're looking at a loved one, the experience of looking at that loved one, you're not thinking, well, now my ventral tegmental field is squirting a little dopamine. Dopamine is now engaging my amygdala. You know, and the problem is that we don't have what's called a one-to-one level of correlation. In other words, we don't have what's called type physicalism that can be expressed and experienced. So I, like everyone else, is sort of making the extrapolation that, well, I feel A, B, and C, and I'm pretty sure from what I've learned in school and through my own research that A, B, and C is somehow involved with X, Y, and Z processes. So I'll go with that. Where it gets really interesting is, you know, when you put people proverbially in the scanner, you know, and of course, I think there's a wonderful paper that was written a few years ago. It says, through a scanner darkly. Brain science is a science. There are sciences of correlation. I mean, they're really not causality. And this has been, I think that's really important to bring to the fore here for our listeners as well. The cognitive scientist and philosopher Owen Flanagan has offered great caution in many of these interpretive neuroscientific studies. And let me give you a reason for that. I mean, I think that what we find is we can see individual patterns in particular people, and we may even be able to see patterns of groups of individuals that can be correlated in ways that create clades or sort of dimensions, if you will, categories of the way people's brains function. And there may be a lot of reasons for that. Genomes and genetics, phenotypes, environments, combination of all of the above. But still, brain science is a science of correlation. You know, we don't know how the great stuff of mindfulness or consciousness or emotion happens in that gray stuff that sits beneath the bones of our head. So until we do, there's still a bit of speculation, but the short answer to the question is, I think it's important to appreciate what we know in the brain sciences and what that might mean, but also to take that with, I think, a bit of relative consideration for what we don't yet know, and further research is needed. Just the kind of work you're doing, Rob. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing where it's research and practice. It's a living laboratory.
You know, one of the things that I've found interesting, but not always easy to, I'm far from qualified to necessarily help somebody through it, but it's this idea that sometimes we loop, so the story loops and gets bigger and more cemented into our minds. And you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I have a business, and so I can see sometimes with team members, with other people that we're dealing with in the business community, where these sort of worldviews and loops get going. A lot of times, they're not useful loops. They become you know, detrimental loops. And I'm curious what's happening there, and is there a way to unwire it and have a new kind of loop that's more useful?
Well, you've raised a very good point. You know, as we age, I mean, literally developmentally from infancy into early childhood, adolescence, et cetera, our brains become more of a past to present to future processor. There's a particular form of processing that's called Bayesian processing that essentially matches things to prior samples so as to be able to gain their familiarity. And the loops you're talking about are in fact quite real. I mean, we base our present upon our experience, our erudition, and our insights to what happened in the past. If A, B, and C happened in the past, there's going to be a probability that D, E, F will happen. Mm-hmm. And I can intervene in these particular ways based on my past experiences. And if it's known to me, I match it to sample. That's what neural processing is all about. Matching currency to previousness to plan and predict for the future. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when those things become reinforced via trial and error learning, via circumstances, via ecologies, we develop those types of node and network fortitudes, literally circuits in the brain, both functionally as well as structurally. And those structures can be microstructures with regard to the fortitude strength that exist in those connecting spaces between nerve cells called synapses. And in some cases, they can actually be much more metastructural, whereby now there are actual pathways, tracks, if you will, that have changed the nature of the protein interaction and literally create bridges and fortified accessory cells called glia. Mm-hmm. And now what we see is this then becomes a loop. So what we know about brains is brains are dynamical systems that are embedded in a system. They have systems characteristics, complexity characteristics. They're sensitive to initial conditions, and they're guided by particular attracting forces. And those attracting forces are functional and structural. And then there's an ongoing relationship between structure and function within the brain that says, when I perceive X, I will respond in ways Y and Z because that's what I've done in the past. Can I rewire that? Indeed, I can. In some cases, it takes a bit of work. And other times, what it's really required there is inculcation and then reinforcement by principle and action. The kind of retreats and seminars you're providing, I think, allow individuals that period of time to step back, to prescind, to take a look at the forest and not be so embedded within the trees. And that can be really useful.
Do you think, so I'm going to use two examples here, both in leadership positions, both successful. One, this is a friend who says, I'm just lucky. Just everything seems to work out. And it does. It does seem that way. I have another friend. He has a certain relationship with money and things are always tight. And it seems as though it's the way he's always going about certain things. And I'm curious about the mindset and what's happening in our minds. Is there a correlation to the one who says, I'm just always lucky, and that it seems as though lucky things always turn up for him, and you know, the other side of it with the other friend? And just one more thing, I say this thing, this is for me personally, and it's really kind of a silly thing in a way. I say, I always get great parking spaces, and I do. And I always wonder about that. Like, how does that happen?
Well, serendipity and stochasticity aside, I mean, there is the old adage that says the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that is translatable on a variety of levels, from the cellular all the way to the social. Mm-hmm. Let me explain what I mean by that. We know that we can train individuals to really hone in both their observation and orientation skills. You know, again, if we think back of the simplified model of biases or dispositions that feed into the way we observe the world, and then we orient to certain things, we know that the process that changes from sensation, what's out there that is being impinged upon us, and our perception of that is an active process. And those perceptions, those orientations, feed into our decisions. What did I do before? What were the consequences of that? And that guides our actions. And a lot of that is deeply ingrained as a consequence of this form of Bayesian learning, sort of trial, error, and then consequential bias and dispositional learning. And so when we say, you know, look, I feel that I'm pretty lucky, what's probably happening there is that this is an individual who, through time, experience, exposure, erudition, and probably trial and error, has found that certain patterns of reaction, relation, decisions, and actions have resulted in consequences, and engaging in those orientations, decisions, and actions in a particular patterned way has reliable outcomes. For your other friend who says, you know, I'm just an unlucky guy and money goes through my fingers like water through a sieve. Mm-hmm. It may very well be that the way he perceives money, spending, acquisition of wealth on a variety of levels is such that his decisions to what he's going to spend things on may have a highly impulsive nature, for example, or maybe not consider all the variables. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, what he's not doing, and what many of us fail to do, is take the lens that allows us mm-hmm. to look into the brain and flip it around as a mirror that allows us to look at ourselves and say, all right, how am I going through the decision process? What are those emotional things that are constituent to my cognitions? Because emotions and cognitions are, in fact, one and the same. All of our thoughts are embedded with some emotionality, even if it's minor. And then how does that amalgam of emotion and cognition feed into and direct my decisions? And very often by doing that, through the process, for example, of mindfulness, introspection, we can get better insight to how we're feeling about certain things, how we observe and orient, and how those observations and orientations fuel into our decisions.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, just following up on this, just as I understand it, and I could be totally wrong, but it's the idea that the brain has like already this preconceived notion of what something's going to look like or should look like. And so it's not that we necessarily see the world as it really is, but more like how we see the world through how we are, right, or who we are. And so it's almost like the brain's augmenting our reality, even if it's not an exact representation of reality. Is that correct?
I love that phrase. I'm going to use that a lot. I promise I'll give you credit. The brain is an augmented or virtual reality device. That's absolutely true. You know, yeah. And I think the example that I'll provide both to this discussion and to the listeners is very, very simple. I mean, if any of our listeners out there wear glasses, take your glasses off. Literally take your glasses off and look at the environment around you. And depending if you're near or farsighted or astigmatic, that vision will change. The world hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Your sensation of the world has changed. Your perception of the world has changed. And with it, the relative clarity of your cognitive processes that go with it. You can't read the sign on the wall. You can't read what's in front of you, for example. Things change. So what we're really seeing is that our body is an element, an instrument of filtration. And this goes back to some older philosophical thought that basically contends that the thing as it is out there is one thing, but our reality is the reality that is constructed for us by our, quote, mind's eye, the assimilative and synthetic processes that go from reception to sensation to perception to cognitive processing. And that cognitive processing then relates not only what we're seeing, to what we're seeing, to what we know and what we remember, and projecting that into the future to what that might mean for us. So the embeddedness of our embodiedness, I think, really plays a role here. Once again, where mindfulness can come into play to take a step out and say, what is this really? What does this mean? and to do that reappraisal step, which we're capable of doing, but very often, again, the speed and the comfort of those, quote, loops that we've gotten used to, because this is the way it always goes, I think create a relative commonality for us that sometimes it may be important to step aside, reexamine, and revise.
Rob, kind of making this a little more like on the practical side for the listeners. So they're like, well, this is all great and very fascinating, but what is there some simple things you have people do to have these experiences? Like, you know, do people need to sit down for, you know, an hour every day, or is there some quicker tips that they have to suggest? Or what's the process like where we can start to, really activate this brain in a more positive way?
Yeah, you know, I think I don't have the perfect answer for that. I don't know that anybody does, but I always think of it a little bit in this way. First, you have to recognize that there's something going on and you want it to sort of change, and you have to believe that it can. Mm. And so somewhat similar to when we're ill and we go to the doctor and they write us a prescription, what's your prescription going to be? Usually we go and get our prescription filled and we diligently take our medicine until we're better. And this is in my mind, a lifelong prescription that we take, and it's an essentially a routine that we get on a regular basis. Mm. As it relates to meditation, which is just one part of it, but there's also other very important, I like to call them the simple six things, because they're six things that we all kind of, many people are challenged with, but they're simple to recognize how important they are. And to me, it starts with that foundation of meditation, so you can cultivate an awareness of the other five. And the awareness is, am I getting enough sleep? Am I getting the right nutrition? Am I moving regularly? Am I connecting with other people? And am I expressing gratitude on a regular basis? And if you can put together the right prescription for you that incorporate those things and stick to taking the medicine on a daily basis, you will start to, at some point, move the needle. And so that's the best way that I've been able to describe it to people in a more practical manner.
That's great, because I know, and I'm sure Jim will have some points on these, but those are like the main ways you change your brain, right?
Exactly right. That's a very, very good go by. Tyler, you're in Japan, correct?
Yes, correct.
So, you know, I spent 30 years on a judo mat getting beat up. And interestingly, I played Japanese judo, Kodokan judo. And there's a concept in judo, which is sort of a meditative process. It's the zazen practice called mokso, which is you focus. And that can be immediate and short term to just gain some perspective, to kind of prescind, to step out a little bit, and or to delve more deeply. And one uses it, for example, at the beginning of judo practice. One can use it in the middle of judo practice, characteristically after a form of free play called randori. And then you use it at the end. And when we were competing, the idea was, okay, after each round of your contest, of your shiai, you come off the mat, get into a quiet place and say, all right, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? Why did I win that one? Why did I lose that one? What does that mean? Mm. My colleague, Professor Nico Kohls, working in Fortune 100 and 500 companies, primarily in Germany and throughout Europe, utilizes the very same sets of practices. He kind of decontextualizes it off of the judo mat or the wrestling mat. But if you think of leadership in many ways, those types of sports, the individual who is out there on their own, yet doing something for a team, that's very, very real. The analogy holds. And what Professor Kohls' work has done in many ways is demonstrated the neurocognitive similarities to what Rob is saying here. We take moments, and those moments can be brief, like taking the pill, if you will, taking the medicine. But then as a consequence of that, as with any medicament, what we're doing is we're increasing or decreasing certain aspects of our physiology. And if we do it acutely or if we do it chronically, that can then induce changes that are not only in the short term, but more perdurable. And the more we do it, like taking a drug, the more effect it has. It's changing the system, if you will, the function of the system. And we know that by changing functions, we can change structures on a variety of levels, from the molecular all the way to the mass effect. And that can be very, very useful, because what it allows us to do, if you will, is neurocognitively, quote, self-medicate through a set of practices that can be very important for dynamic styles of not only leadership, but for contribution and participation.
Great. No, I love the back and forth here. I love how Rob's just, it's such a simple kind of practice of awareness and then asking those questions. And it's something that anybody can do, any leader can do. And it can be helpful. And I'm curious, Rob, since you started doing this meditation practice, what have you seen in your business?
Well, first, and I mentioned it a little at the outset, it's a greater ability to be fully present with people or teams, and maybe less formulating in my mind, but just fully listening. And then maybe later formulating. And so not that that's something that I'm perfect at, far from it, but I've noticed my ability to do that and have a greater focus on a regular basis. The other thing would be a greater sense of letting go of the ego, of allowing a vulnerability to come to the forefront. This served us very well, I think, in one, what I would say, practical way, which is many years ago when we decided to start practicing open book finance and, you know, showing people what the numbers are at a very granular level so they could better make decisions for the company and better understand the health of the company. And for many that are in business, my experience is more within the entrepreneurial community, that's a very difficult thing for people to let go of. So that is another area where I found it to be useful.
That's great. And Jim, follow-ups on that?
I couldn't agree more. And so many important points are embedded in what Rob has just said. You know, again, neurocognitively, if we do some of the psychological and behavioral work and then try to correlate that to what's happening with various brain nodes and networks, there's a really wonderful word that leaders can use. And that word is because. And the reason for that is that humans are tool users. And one of the tools that we like to use is knowledge. You know, we're afraid of the proverbial boogeyman under the bed. And we're afraid of the dark. And the unknown is difficult for us to deal with. And very often what we'll do is when there is an unknown there, we'll bridge that unknown with our expectations, anticipations, and anxieties. And that becomes problematic because that then may trigger for us certain behaviors that are actually not apt or viable or productive for the situation at hand. But we're going by our gut, because we don't know what's there. The more that is known to us, the more factual information, the more we're able to make that because clause, I'm doing A and B because of C, that level of transparency is a tool that we can utilize in our cognitive toolkit. What it does is it creates certain likenesses, certain correlations for us, and we do well with that. Again, the more facts we have, inclusive of we may not have all the facts, the better we're able to link that to past experiences in a way that justifies our behaviors and predicts our behaviors for the future. So that level of leadership transparency, using because we're doing this because these are the finances, and because of these finances, these are some things we may have to do, or what things should we do? This is why I'm making these actions and suggesting these changes because of A, B, and C, X, Y, and Z, has been really very, very useful. And the idea of stepping back to listen more, to look more intuitively, to get a better sense of the thing, can be very, very important in prompting not only leadership dynamics, but participatory dynamics. If I may, a little example that I give with some of my doctoral students, and many of them hate me for it, if I'm giving them an essay exam, very often one of the things that I'll do, particularly if I know they're all doing well, and sometimes the exam is just cursory, is the very last question is, do not answer any of the questions on this exam. And what you find is the individuals who are more what I'll call inherent leaders will read all of the information first, whereas those that tend to be more participatory followers will jump in and start answering question one, question two, question three, big picture. Get the big picture. Mm-hmm. And I say that before I even distribute the exam booklet. I said, look, try to get the big picture of the information here. A lot of these questions are correlative. So many things are in life, blah, 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 blah. Huh. And yet there are always those individuals who have that knee-jerk reaction whose observation and orientation say, I have to get through this exam quickly. I need to answer this. And they're spilling out information. And there are plenty who just sit back and go, oh, this was pretty cool. And even in those situations, their colleagues can't figure out why are these people not writing? And they make the assumption, oh, I'm writing so much because I know so much more than this person or that person. Well, you know, it's perspectival. So what Rob is putting forward, I think, represents not only a very good leadership skill, I think it's also very useful for those of us who are being led and may become good leaders one day to understand the value of fact.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just to build on that, Jim, yeah. I always think about, well, what's the story going on in the team's heads? And there'll be lots of them. And so the more information they have, to your point, the more they understand the same story. But what I think is also useful is their involvement in creating the story. So, you know, I think one of the things that served us well is being highly collaborative. And, you know, especially in this environment where there's a lot of uncertainty and businesses are struggling for all the, at least here, you know, well, I think around the world, because we're not doing commerce like we normally do. And so the fear bar is high right now for people. And so how can they get involved and how can they understand what's happening and actually make it create action to move the needle forward so they feel at least more settled? It doesn't mean the result is exactly what they want it to be because of the environment. It might not be able to, but they're involved. And so the story is much different and maybe a little bit more comforting.
I couldn't agree more. You know, what that does is that actually reinforces the because clause.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What it's saying is because I'm doing A, B, and C, these things are happening within my organization, within the system to which I am then a part of and participatory. So the because aspect, again, reciprocally in leadership becomes very important. We need you to do this because, but because you are doing these things, these are some directions we can go in and these are the desired directions. What it does is it really engenders and enfranchises individuals who are being led to the process of their own participation. Mm-hmm. Excellent points.
Well, one of the things that I think is even to take that to another level is to say, instead of saying, we need you to do this because, we say, here's the picture. What do we need to do? Now you figure it out.
Correct.
Yeah. They get to make their own because, right?
Right. Exactly.
So I'd like to wrap up here, just be conscious of time. But I also have like this one question I'd like to pose for you both. It's just something I'm kind of curious about and what you both think about it. And it's this idea of, my idea is human, I'd say like consciousness is like the currency of humanity. And I'm curious what you think about that statement.
Ooh.
I'll start with Rob.
Good.
That's not fair. That is so unfair. You started with me at the beginning. Human consciousness is the currency of society.
Or just currency of being human or of humanity.
Of humanity. What do I think of that statement? I think there's accuracy around it. It's how conscious we are and how we show up for each other as humans. And I think that's a very important thing. And especially, again, just to come back to these unique times that we're a part of, you know, how can we start to maybe think about that in a different way? You know, compassion comes to mind at a larger scale. there are many that are compassionate, but maybe at a larger scale. Community of the world. You know, this is the first time in my 50 years being on this earth that I've really, knowing that we're all connected, but this is so much different because we're all dealing with the exact same thing at the pretty much the exact same time, mm-hmm. give or take. And so we, it just reinforces for me how interconnected we really are.
And Jim,
I'll barrel roll the answer on that because I think Rob's point is spot on. So this is me really sitting here with my brain scientist hat on.
Yes.
We don't know what consciousness is. Yeah. We have no idea. I'm just finishing out a piece for publication that looks at whether the brain is a generator, mm-hmm. an antenna, or a receptacle, or some combination of all of the above, which to go to your point, Tyler, that's what currency is. Think about it. Mm-hmm. If we were to look at currencies worldwide, they don't all have the same shape. They don't all have the same weight. They don't all have the same printing. They're not uniform. So what we know is currencies, although serve a purpose literally as a medium of exchange that has value and worth, they're differential. Within the niche of whatever that currency is being used, they have value. But if we take it outside of that particular ecosphere or geopolitical locale, the value changes. The same is true of consciousness. I think as human currency, what we have to understand is that our consciousness may be common to us as humans, but the self, the nature of the self and the subjectivity of that self is strongly nested within not only an individual's embodiment, but individuals' embeddedness in their culture. But more than that, the point of compassion, literally compatior, to feel with, I think becomes important to understand in a little bit larger construct. Right now in the neurosciences, we're flirting with the idea of something that is a form of panpsychism, but not really. It's really more of cosmobiopsychism. And what that means is that living creatures apparently assemble this thing that is their nervous system that creates a generator, is a receptacle, and is an antenna for consciousness in some way. And that means that probably all living creatures have some form of it, or are at very, very least have the capability of some form of it. It may not be human, but it's there, and that opens the door for a broader set of compassion. But where the commonalities lie, we know, for example, all humans, is certainly in the fact that we are conscious, both of ourselves and others. And I think that consciousness as a currency compels compassion.
You know, thank you both for being here. And as always, I like to end with the final question is, what is one word you would like to leave for future leaders? I'll start with Jim, because I've started with Rob a couple times. So I'll start with Jim. What's one word you want to leave?
I'll reinforce the word I used before.
Great.
Prudence. Look at oneself reflectively, look at others respectfully, and be prudent.
Right. And Rob, what's one word?
Mine would be love.
Love. Great. Well, thank you both for being here, Jim and Rob. Really appreciate your time, your energy, your insights, your wisdom.
Well, thanks, Tyler. It's always a pleasure. And nice meeting you, Rob.
Likewise. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.